Dobry wieczór Państwu. Witam na drugim.
Dear ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the second event of the literary series organized by the Krakow Festival Office at the Jewish Culture Festival, and we have Charles King, a historian, author of two books on two very interesting cities and published in Poland, and cities that really correspond to the idea of the main slogan of this festival, which is Jerusalem. But we're thinking in terms of this literary series of the festival, we're thinking of the city as a model of a city, a multicultural city. This multiculturalism is a defining feature of that city. So we are, we will be talking about another city, not Jerusalem, which is multicultural, where East meets West, where modernist trends of the Muslim civilization met with what the Europeans wanted to see in Istanbul, because this is the city. So Occidentalism is meeting with Orientalism, and Max Cegielski will moderate the discussion.
Nie ma jeszcze słuchawek, to są tam do wzięcia. I'm really honored and really pleased that we can talk with Charles, because of course me as the author of a book about Istanbul as well, when Czarne Publishing House published his book O północy w Pera Palas, narodziny współczesnego Stambułu, just the very first day when it was in the bookshops, I bought it because I wanted to check what was Charles' idea, how to write about Istanbul. And as I understand, the organizers of this event allowed me to not be only a journalist asking questions, but also to share a little bit of my experience about Istanbul, and try to connect my book Oko Świata, Eye of the World, with Charles' book. But of course, because he's a very special guest coming from afar, so I will give for sure him much more time to talk. And I think that this point of reference, Jerusalem, is quite a good one. I mean, it's not like artificial idea in the minds of the curators of this festival, because I think it's there is a huge connection, and I think that both of us, we felt in love with Istanbul because of its very complex, very complicated, but very multicultural history. Of course, that it doesn't exist at this level anymore, yeah. But I think that we should start, Charles, with like explaining, because also I think that now, because of the so huge Islamophobia that we have in United States, in Europe as well, it's quite hard to imagine for the people that one of the biggest Muslim empires, Ottoman Empire, we have to remember that the Sultan of Ottoman Empire was also a caliph, so he was the most important person in the world of Islam. Yeah, he was maybe to say as a pope is not exactly correct, but to imagine his position. Yeah, so until 20s, yeah, and the Ottoman Sultan was then from this family. We had the very last existing Muslim caliph, yeah. So, So it's hard to imagine how this Ottoman Empire was also so multi-ethnic, yeah. And if you can, if you can explain a little bit this idea, because also I think, I mean, that's how I feel your story and your book, that it's a starting point as well, yeah.
Yeah, well, thanks so much, Max. It's a it's an honor to be with you as someone who loves Turkey and loves Istanbul and it's the many faces of Turkey as much as I do. It's also a pleasure to be here in Krakow, and so let me thank the organizers and Çarne, the publishing house, in that organized all of this for me. My wife's great-grandfather is from Krakow, and so I feel like I'm vicariously coming home in a way. So, Grandpa, wherever you are, I'm here myself. To understand Istanbul ought to be very easy for people from Krakow in particular, because the thing you have to do to understand Istanbul is to take yourself out of a national frame of mind and put yourself in an imperial frame of mind. So in empires before the age of the nation state, people thought of themselves and of their communities in ways very different from how we are taught to think about ourselves and our communities now. Is that okay? Okay. So you have to take yourself out of that national frame, put yourself in an imperial frame. What does an imperial frame mean? Well, it means, first of all, that you are in a hierarchy of power, right? With the sultan at the top or the kaiser or whoever it happens to be at the top. And everything flows down from that very hierarchical structure. Secondly, the community to which you fundamentally belong is not necessarily a national one. In the case of the Ottoman Empire, of Imperial Istanbul, it was a religious community. And that religious community didn't always translate very easily into a national frame. So the one community, I think, that illustrates that better than any other is, of course, the Jewish community, the Sephardic Jewish community in Istanbul, but also a community that we often forget about, but that was very important in the history of that city, called the Levantine community. So the Levantine community, you can't really translate Levantine into a modern national vocabulary, but it was an important community of mainly French and to a degree Italian-speaking Catholics who were fundamental to the business networks all over the Eastern Mediterranean from the 13th or 14th century all the way up to the early 20th century. And there's still a very small Levantine community, or people who would call themselves Levantine, in Istanbul today. So one of the things that I try to do in the books I write is to complicate a set of stories that we have learned to tell because we live in an age in which the nation state is the dominant way of organizing our communities. We have a national anthem, we have national museums, we have national flags, we have national costumes, so the nation is around us all the time. But part of, I think, doing good history, especially on multicultural, multi-ethnic spaces like this, is to complicate our understanding of the past and take it out of that national frame. The other thing I will say, though, is that every place is historically a multi-ethnic and multicultural place. I don't need to say that being here in Krakow, but every place is historically that. But that does not mean that you then have to tell history as a kind of parade of nationalities, right? Here come the Jews, here come the Turks, here come the Poles. That's not the way I like to tell history because people didn't actually experience history in that way. People were members of neighborhoods, they were members of professional guilds, they were members of families, they were members of, you know, this mosque as opposed to that mosque. They lived on this side of the Bosphorus or that side of the Bosphorus. They were local or they were foreign. All of these categories, all of these communities are the way in which most of us, most of the time, experience our lives. And that's the way that Istanbulus and the Ottoman Empire in the 1920s or 30s, the period that this book is concerned with, that's how they experience their lives. And it's a reminder to us to complicate our own understanding of the past.
Yeah, and I think it's always important to write about Istanbul because it's always like Jerusalem and an example that we can live in a very different way, which is now somehow really hard to imagine. Yeah, because as you said, we have the national flags, we have the national this and that, but the subjects of the Ottoman Sultan, they were the part of the empire. Yeah, there was no nation at this time. Of course, Charles' book is describing in a very interesting way how it all changed, yeah, and how at the same the Istanbul, which was before and capital of the Ottoman Empire, then was just a big city in Turkey, yeah, the world which, as far as I remember, didn't really exist in 19th century, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but why you decided, I mean, to start your story? Because yeah, it's mainly 20s and 30s, like the beginning of the Republic, of the Turkish Republic. But also, of course, you are writing a lot about like the end of 19th century, when the beginning of 20th century, when the Ottoman Empire slowly started to, you can say, modernized on one hand, but on the other hand, it was changing in a way that a lot of stuff was under control of the foreign business, foreign empires as well. Yeah, so it was the Ottoman Empire was trying to change to keep this independence, keep the freedom, keep itself some, I don't know, nature, but also all the elites, they knew that they have to change. Yeah.
So the Turkish Republic is founded in 1923. It's a very young state by the standards of most other European countries. And it was founded on a very radical idea. And the radical idea was that this piece of territory that used to be called the Ottoman Empire is no longer an imperial structure, but it's going to be a nation state. And a nation state created for and created by a specific national group called the Turks. The problem was that in 1923, there really weren't that many Turks, meaning there weren't a lot of people who already and obviously thought of themselves with a label called Turkish. You might have used an Ottoman label that, you know, you would be religiously Armenian or religiously Catholic or religiously Christian Orthodox or religiously Jewish or Muslim. And that would be a category, a label that would be meaningful to people. It also was politically meaningful at the time. No one, very few people, called themselves Turks. And so the founder of the Turkish Republic, who came to be called Atatürk, Mustafa Kemal, to give him his original name, developed a saying at the time, after he became Turkish president, that you will find engraved on busts and statues of Atatürk all over Turkey. I'll say it in Turkish, Nemulu Türküm dene. That is, it means, how happy is the person who can say, I am a Turk. To say I am a Turk was almost like a profession of faith, meaning I'm no longer any of these other categories that might matter. I'm no longer just a Muslim. There are lots of Muslims in the world. I'm going to be a Turk as a sort of national category. And so Turkey begins this process that in many other European states had taken 100 years, 150 years, 200 years. Turkey tries to do it in about a decade or so, to create from scratch an ethnically, culturally defined nation to fill up the state that had succeeded the Ottoman Empire. And one of the ways, amazingly, in which Turks do this, of course, is through a whole series of legislation, laws that are focused on, specifically on the idea of nation building. To give you one example, in 1935, the Turkish Republic passed a surname law. Before 1935, rather few Muslims in the Ottoman Empire had inheritable family names. So you think about why would you need an inheritable family name? Well, you need an inheritable family name so that the state can keep track of you. It's really for the benefit of the state. It's not really for the benefit of your family. I mean, you know who your father is, who your mother is. You know who your children are. You don't need to remind yourself, oh, yeah, they have my same family name. Oh, they must be related to me. No, it's the state that is interested primarily in the inheritance of family names. And so the Turkish state in 1935 requires all Turkish citizens, Muslim, non-Muslim, to take family names. And so that's why so many Turks today have absolutely magnificent family names, if you translate them literally. Because if you think about it, in 1935, you get to decide for all of your descendants, for all time, what they're going to call themselves, right? So what are you going to choose? You better choose something good, right? You better choose something good. And so that's why, you know, many Turkish names are wonderful, like, you know, Thunderbolt and Iron Hand and Pure Steel and Pure Turk. Or if you're the president of the country, you get to choose Father of the Turks, Atatürk, literally, as your surname. And, you know, that is a process that is in a way kind of amusing, but it's not that different from the same process that takes place in lots and lots of nation states all across Europe, where the process of nation building is about the state convincing you that the things that are convenient for the state are natural to you. Right? So think about that. The things that are convenient to the state are natural, should be natural to you. Like thinking of a national costume or going to a national museum or having a set of feelings about a national flag. People have to be taught how to do that. The remarkable thing about Istanbul or Turkey is that you get to see that whole process speeded up and put right on the front of people's minds, but it's not that different from the process that takes place in lots of places.
Yeah. But it's, I think it's really important because actually by talking about this amazing city, Istanbul, in which we can see Turkey, but we start to think about ourselves now. And I think that your book and also what I wanted to do is not just to write about the past, because like all these questions and problems, they are like still important, because in a way we can say that now you're like inducing a riot because it starts people, wait, think why it's all like this. But we have to explain, because I mean I expect and understand that a lot of our guests audience that they know the book very well. Wszyscy książkę przeczytali Charlesa, nie wszyscy. Tak.
Thank you.
Everybody. Okay. So maybe we have to explain a little bit how you build this story, because we already had with Charles conversation that in my book Pera Palace Hotel is just one chapter, and he's building his story, making it around the history of one hotel. So maybe if you can tell me more about this hotel and why you choose this as a sort of focus as the main point.
So the Kara Palace Hotel is the last of the old 19th century grand hotels that still exists in Istanbul. It was established in 1892 by a Belgian company called the Wagon Lee Company. And that was a company that ran the very famous rail line called the Orient Express that went from Paris to Istanbul. And once the railway was established, the railway company realized that for many European guests who would be taking that route, they would need a place to stay that was up to European standards. And so they built this hotel on a piece of territory that had belonged to a Muslim pious foundation that then belonged to an Armenian family and then was acquired by this Belgian multinational firm. When I was living in Istanbul in the late 1990s, I had a Fulbright scholarship there from the United States. And I would sometimes, when I should have been doing other things, I would go have a drink in the Parapalace bar. And at that time, the Parapalace Hotel was very run down. It was not a very fancy place to stay, and which meant that as a young assistant professor, I could afford to have a drink there. And it dawned on me at that time that you could almost, sitting in the bar of this hotel, tell the story of Turkey's history, of Istanbul's history, of the fall of empires and the rise of nation states by watching who was coming into the lobby and who was going out of the lobby, who was checking into the hotel, who was checking out of the hotel. And so I had this idea almost as a literary device to put the hotel kind of at the center of the story of this book I eventually wanted to write. The other thing that I discovered in beginning to work on this book, though, was a remarkable source of evidence for the history of this period that I had never really come across before. And it ended up being something that was very important to the way the book developed. And that is a series of photographs that were put together by a wonderful Turkish photographer and photograph collector named Selahattin Giz. His family name was Giz. And he had worked as a photographer in the 1930s and 40s all the way up to the 1970s or 80s, and he also collected the photographs of other people. And what you'll find in the book is that each chapter is sort of loosely built around a specific photograph from Istanbul in the interwar period, 1920s to 1940s, roughly. And the photographs are really magnificent because they open your eyes to a world that many of us can no longer imagine. And let me tell you about one photograph in particular that just stunned me when I saw it. I was sitting in an archive in Istanbul going through about 150,000 of Giz's photographs. And unfortunately, they were digitized on a computer, and so you could go through them rather quickly. And I saw this one photograph, and I almost fell out of my seat. Because about 6 months before, I had been working at an archive in my hometown, Washington, D.C., reading the reports of American diplomats from the 1920s about what was happening in Turkey at that time. You know, consular officers, diplomats, they write a report about what's happening in the country where they're stationed, and the U.S. National Archives has saved all of these things. So I had connected up a document I had seen with now a visual representation of this event. What was the event? It was the first meeting of the club of former eunuchs of the imperial harem. I don't know what eunuch would, how you translate the word eunuch. Is that clear to everyone?
Eunuch.
Thank you. the black eunuchs of the imperial harem. And the photograph, it's in the book, is a group of men of African heritage who are wearing starched collars and wool suits like you would from the 1920s. And the label at the bottom was first meeting of the club of the former black eunuchs of the imperial harem. Nobody had ever seen that photograph before. And if you look at the book, this is the no one has seen it before it was published in the book. And that, I thought, yeah, there it is. There are the guys. This, to me, was an incredible revelation. Because think about the lives of these men. Right? One might say they gave up a lot for their profession. They were people who were at the center of the empire. They lived in the sultan's innermost household, the harem, the private area of the sultan's household. They guarded the women. They guarded the children of the imperial household. They were very trusted. They were men who were extremely well trained in how to work in an imperial palace. But this photograph is taken in 1928. There is no empire. There is no imperial palace. There is no sultan anymore. There's no caliph of the Ottoman Empire. There's no Ottoman Empire anymore. And these people were, to me, a kind of time traveler. You know, they had lived, they had made their lives according to one set of rules that they took for granted. They are now living in an era in which everything they thought was real, stable, and obvious has now gone away. And I thought, what a remarkable example of the way in which, in an age of the fall of empires, the rise of nation states, the First World War, the end of the Russian Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, what a remarkable example of how many, many, many people had to live their lives. They had to reinvent themselves. They had to question their sense of the obvious. They had to figure out how to keep their families safe and how to make a living in a set of circumstances very different from what they experienced before. They became immigrants. They became refugees. And so much of the book is, in fact, about exactly that process. Because it turns out that in this era, in the era between the two world wars, the thing that was most remarkable about Istanbul as a place is that it was teeming with wave after wave after wave of refugees.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that if you already said this, that we have to move to the Russians in Istanbul, because one of the, this is amazing how Charles is a professor, how his research is deep and accurate, and how many details you have in this book, photographs, but also about the music, which I hope that we will talk about as well. But one of the I think very important chapters are this about the Russians, because I think what is also important that on one hand you had the empire was falling down, falling apart, but on the other hand, because of the Russian Revolution, because of the First War, it was like mixing again, or it was mixed again. Yeah, the Istanbul, like the new waves of people, like new ethnicities, new cultures, new ways of life were coming to this city. So also I understand that you did this book because it concentrates on 20s and 30s. It goes all the way up to 55. We'll talk later why this is so important, 1955. But the Istanbul was like teeming with, as you said, with about eunuchs, that you still had like this some elements of this old culture, mm-hmm. but also the new culture. So why Russians were so important?
Of course, the Ottoman Empire collapses in a way in 1918 because the imperial capital is occupied from that point until 1923 by the Allied forces. So the British, the French, and the Italians divide up the city into zones of occupation, much in the way that Berlin, after the Second World War, is divided up into zones of occupation. And after that period, the thing that would have impressed you most if you were living in Istanbul at the time was what we would today call a massive refugee crisis. So the population during that period of Allied occupation of Istanbul is about 700,000 people. It's not very big at all, 700,000 people. Within about 6 months after the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia and the beginning of the Russian Civil War, another 120,000 Russian refugees come into the city. So beginning population is 700,000. You add another 120,000 refugees to it. You can get a sense that the scale of this was unimaginable. I mean, not even close to Syrians in Europe today. I mean, not even close, right? So that if you were walking down the streets of Istanbul in 1919 and 1920 and 1921, if you encountered a poor person begging on the street, that person was likely to speak Russian. That person was likely to be a Russian refugee. It might be a former count or a former countess who had been pushed out by the Bolsheviks. This transforms the city because not only does it bring in loads of people who are desperate and poor and selling everything they can, their jewels and their furs and the family silver, in order to feed themselves. But if you read the Turkish Muslim memoirs of this period, it's fascinating because Turkish Muslims in 1919 and 1920 say exactly the same thing about Europeans that Europeans now say about Muslim refugees in Europe. It's amazing. These people don't integrate. They don't learn our language. I hate their food, right? They're not clean. All of this stuff that Europeans now often say about refugees, yeah, it's exactly switched. And so Istanbul is a very important mirror on our own moment where all of the players are in a way switched around.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, like... And again, it's just important to try to imagine like something opposite, yeah, something from a different point of view. Yeah. And also all these Russians, they bring to Istanbul, they need work, so, and because they are connected to all this like aristocratic, tsarist way of life that they have to abandon. So you have a lot of people who are like opening new restaurants, cafes, big bands. Prostitution as well, which was a really huge problem at this time in Istanbul. Yeah. And but are you sure that it really changed a way of the Muslim Turks of Istanbul? I mean, because then most of these Russians, they left, but as far as I understand, and they left a mark. I mean,
Yeah. So the Russians themselves eventually move on. I mean, there is a small Russian community in Istanbul. Actually, there's a rather large Russian community in Istanbul now, but that's a product of the 1990s and the early 2000s. But there are still some families who went back to that 1920 immigration as well. But most of them eventually moved on to Warsaw, to London, to Berlin, to Paris, and Prague, and to other cities. In fact, perhaps the most famous Russian refugee to come through at the time is, he was a teenager at the time named Vladimir Nabokov, who escaped on a ship from Odessa, spent a little bit of time in Istanbul, and then moved with his parents farther to the west, and of course eventually to the United States. But they left a mark because they bring with them a different way of doing urban life. So they bring, for example, the concept of a restaurant. I mean, a restaurant is a very strange thing when you think about it. You know, you're going to go to a place where there are a bunch of tables with other people, strangers you don't know, consuming food with you that you've just ordered from someone from a list that someone presents to you, and then they may do a stage show and entertain you while you're eating your beefsteak. Very strange idea. But the Russians bring this concept to Istanbul, and it really takes off. The idea of a nightclub, and by the way, with loads of particularly young women who are looking for work and might be dancers in a nightclub, even if they were, you know, Princess Levin or whatever back in Russia. And there's some wonderful Giz photographs of exactly these young women in such a nightclub in the 1920s. They bring a new hairstyle called the bob for women. Very popular in the 1920s as well. They changed the fashion. They also bring a thing called jazz. And Istanbul turns out to be particularly rich for jazz music in this era. I sometimes call this book A History of the Hidden Islamic Jazz Age, because there was an Islamic, a very important Islamic Islamic jazz age. There are some Russian dancers in a nightclub in the 20s. And we kind of forget about it when we tell the history of jazz. But I tell a very important story about a few Turks who eventually, from this milieu of Istanbul in this era, end up in my hometown, Washington, D.C. It's two brothers named Ahmet and Nisui Ertegun. They are the sons, the teenage sons, of the first Turkish ambassador to the United States, who was appointed in the 1930s. And they come with him to Washington. They're thrown into this environment that in some ways reminds them of the environment they just left. It's a kind of mixed city. It has an underground. It has an underground jazz scene, which they had experienced in Istanbul as well. And they take the experience of their home city and decide to create a new record label, their own record label, when they're in their 20s. They're young men. And they name it after the big body of water that they have come across in their travels from Istanbul all the way to Washington, D.C. They call it Atlantic Records. And so if you are familiar with the Rolling Stones or Aretha Franklin or anybody who has made a mark on the history of rock and roll or Motown, you have the Ertegun brothers from Istanbul to thank for it. And this was part of this incredibly mixed culture that helped to produce some of the great innovations in music and pop culture as we know it. By the way, you know, jazz, I think, ought to be more a part of our kind of serious history than it often is, about sort of our serious musical history than it often is, because we tend to import our nationalist stories into the history of music, right? So Wagner becomes a German composer, Beethoven becomes a German composer. What is Chopin? Is he Polish?
That's a question.
But you cannot be a jazz nationalist. You can't, right? Because jazz depends on mixing and twisting and changing and making things unfamiliar. And so that's why jazz comes out of places like immigrant New York in the 1920s and 30s, or immigrant Istanbul, immigrant Beirut and Cairo, which also have very important jazz scenes as well.
Mm, yeah, yeah. I mean, if you still don't know this book, it's really great part about the history of music and the Turkish connection, Istanbul connection. But you already, I mean, because you mentioned two, I think, very important things, because we already talk about how Kemal Mustafa Atatürk, how he started to build Turkey as a nation state. And then you said a few words about occupation. And I think that we have to remember that this humiliation of the occupation is one of the reasons, yeah, that drive this nationalistic movement. Because if you imagine the Constantinople, the Istanbul, it was this Philip Mansell book, the city of words, desire. So of course from the European point of view it was like this gate to the Orient, but it was the city that everybody wanted to see. Of course all the stories about harem, they were like all these sexual imaginations, they were completely fake, and it's very interesting that you are exactly even using same word as me, because you are just saying that harem was boring place.
Yes,
yeah,
boring place.
So if you still have some any you know thoughts about harem, it was just a boring place, really. But all the tourists, they still go to see these harem places, and I think it makes them, you know, imagine. But so if you imagine that this is this the most wonderful city in the history, on the coast, on two sides of Bosphorus, etc., and then you have all these English troops on the street, French troops on the street, Senegalese soldiers, in the French army, Italians, etc., and suddenly all these people who were like in the army of Sultan, the in the Ottoman Empire, they have to salute, so to pay respect to the to all these foreigners. Then you start to understand the guys like Kemal Mustafa Atatürk.
That's right. Well, you're right.
Okay, but to give a frame, time frame to all these stories, as we said, it's the Istanbul that doesn't exist anymore, but I think that some elements of it exist, which I think we can talk later. But why 1955? You have to explain.
Yeah. So I wanted to write a book that I thought filled in some of the blank spots in the emergence of modern Turkey. So if you read some very, very good books by Turkish historians, but there are many, but the standard narrative is that 1923, the establishment of the Turkish Republic, was a kind of year zero. And at that moment, somehow the curtain came down or up, depending on how you look at things, and everything changed overnight. Well, like with my imperial eunuchs, of course, everything didn't change overnight. There were people who were left over from that old imperial system who had to readjust themselves to the new reality. And then the narrative typically picks up again in the 1960s or 1970s. But that period from 1923 to the 1950s, really not much has been written about by Turkish historians, because it's a very complicated period. Not everyone became a Kemalist, right? Not everyone loved the idea of a new Turkish Republic. Not everyone loved the idea of secularism or Kemal's version of feminism. Not everyone loved. Certainly if you were on the Turkish left, if you were a Turkish communist, you didn't love the Kemalist system. And I deal with the history of the Turkish left in the book as well. And so what I wanted to do was really talk about the birth of this country in a period that, weirdly enough, most of its historians don't actually write about. And I thought, you know, like in a detective drama, if everybody's noticeably not talking about something, that ought to make you a little suspicious. Well, I was a little suspicious about how we tell the story of the development of this really remarkable country called Turkey.
But just one word, and in 55 is a year.
So 1955 is a good kind of place to end, in a way, because it's the last of what, if we were writing about other parts of Europe, we would call a pogrom. It was the last large-scale state-encouraged and publicly manipulated attack on minorities in Istanbul. And so in 1955, there's a series of riots that end up producing the last of the large-scale waves of Greek and Armenian migration out of the city. And I thought that was a kind of a good place to end in a way, because it sort of marks the final end of the old imperial version of Istanbul. If, you know, most of your minorities are now gone as a result, plenty of Jews also flee at the same time. It seemed a natural kind of break to stop the story.
Yeah, and I agree perfectly that. But still, when we walk through the lanes of Pera, which is this old European part of Istanbul, which is very important to explain that it was this, let's call it European part since the Venetians. Yeah, I mean since Byzantium, yeah, already, and it still is very interesting part of the Istanbul. It's like on the other side from Hagia Sophia, from Blue Mosque, etc. And we still have this like small lanes of these beautiful houses, which and the atmosphere is a little bit, we talked before, mm-hmm, as here in Kazimierz, in a way, because on the fronts of these houses you can see some informations, names which show that they were belonging to Jewish families or Armenian families or Greek families, etc., etc. And right now, of course, they are inhabited by Kurdish people, by Gypsy people, now of course also by the refugees from Syria, yeah, and so it's like a ghost town. I mean, like here, of course, there is this main difference that here in Poland there was a Holocaust, yeah, in even with all these pogroms there was no Holocaust in Istanbul, but you are. And you have a lot of small bars and nightclubs and some. I remember this nightclub, which was like a gay nightclub, which was in this old Masonic lodge. Have you been there?
I haven't been there, but I can imagine there is such a
thing. Yeah, like really crazy place. And so we feel that like every house has his own very long history. And now the owners are gone, yeah, but like a new life is still there, yeah?
Yeah.
And in a way, like this, I don't know, a phantom or a ghost of this old Istanbul, in a way, exists.
Sure. I mean, I think that's true of so many cities around the world. I mean, it's particularly true of European cities where, you know, these cities are built up layer by layer, sort of different communities that inhabit them at different times. And I think it's probably a good reminder to all of us that we are only temporary caretakers of the real estate that we have been given by history. There will be people who come after us who do not look like or believe like or eat like we do. And what do we want to leave behind? You know, do we want to leave behind mainly just our name on a door or a business? Or do we want to leave behind a set of values or a way of seeing the world or some record of what was important to us at this time? I'm a great believer that if you're writing history and writing history well, you need to try to, at some level, get into the mind of people who lived in a different time in a different place. One of the things I did in writing this book and also a history of Odessa that I wrote a few years ago was to get old guidebooks. Like for Istanbul, I purchased a 1930s guidebook on eBay, and I could walk around the city with this 1930s guidebook in my hand, and it was, I think, the closest I will ever come to being in a time machine, because I could look down at this guidebook and it would tell me what was supposed to be right here, or what this street was supposed to be called, or a street that used to be here and isn't anymore, and kind of try to imagine for a moment what the streetscape would have been like, or what the smells of the street would have been like, or the sound would have been like, or how the sun would have come over these buildings and struck the street just here. Because look, somebody had put a grapevine in the ground by this mosque, but there's no sun to hit it now. But at some point, there must have been sun to, you know, hit this grapevine in the courtyard of this mosque. And then you begin to understand, I think, a different way of life, because literally you're trying to understand a different landscape that's presented to you.
But this is a moment in which I have to say that while reading your book, it was like a great pleasure, because as we said, it was like this cornucopia of people, them, stories, this Ottoman but Turkish as well, cornucopia of, like, and you can like dig into these stories and houses and restaurants and bands, etc. But on the other hand, weren't you a little bit afraid? Because I had this problem when doing my book, so that's why I composed it. I did it in a way that I have all these like historical stories also with like Chateaubriand, Pierlotti, etc. But then I went to all these like new quarters of town, like, you know, with Kurdish population, with Alevi population, because I was afraid that when we Westerners, when we start to look at India, Iran, Turkey, etc., and we are too much, you know, about these time machines, then sometimes we are too romantic, you know, that somehow we are like giving a body to these ghosts of the past, yeah, but maybe because of it we are not so much thinking about the present, you know, about struggles, you know, about problems.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. I mean, I think if you're writing history, and I mean, I'm really not a professional historian. I teach in a department of political science, but I sometimes describe myself as an anthropologist of the past, because I'm interested in big social science kind of questions. I just happen to locate them in among a set of people we can never meet because they happen to be dead. And I think you have to, though, when you're writing any kind of history, you have to fight against nostalgia, right? Because nostalgia is really an enemy of history. Nostalgia is putting on a set of spectacles and interpreting things, sort of only remembering the good things about the past, not remembering the bad things about the past, and then probably misremembering the good things while you're at it. You have to struggle against romanticism, and you have to try to be fair, and you have to try to pick, if you're centering your work around a number of characters, as I do in this book, you have to try to pick your characters from a lot of different places. And then, of course, you have to, if you're being a historian, you have to be true to the sources. Right, so you have to have actual evidence from an archive or a photograph or a memoir or something to back up the points that you're making. I also, though, discovered another thing in writing about cosmopolitan or multicultural cities as a particular historical subject. And we sometimes say that the opposite of nationalism is cosmopolitanism. And some people will say, well, aren't you being kind of romantic about this cosmopolitan, these cosmopolitan cities as they might once have existed? But to me, the opposite of nationalism is not cosmopolitanism, it's everyday life. The opposite of nationalism is everyday life, meaning nobody wakes up in the morning, has their coffee, and says, my nation, right? Nobody does that. They think about their family, their job, the worries of the day, how to feed themselves, what to do with the cat and the dog. I mean, all of these things that are the substance of our everyday lives. And what I wanted to try to do in this book was not really talk about cosmopolitanism, although I may use that word every now and then, but really to talk about life as it was experienced by people. And that means talking about sound and smell and food and all sorts of things at the same time.
Yeah, I think it's very important. What are you saying is very important in Poland now, but also it's very important how we approach our history. I mean, if we are in Kazimierz, if we are in Krakow, it's also a question, how do we, when we start to write, I don't know, historic non-fiction books or any sort of books about the past, all these questions comes. So I think it's very important. Of course, I think that me and Charles, we can talk for hours, but if you have any questions, jeśli ktoś ma jakiekolwiek pytania, mogą być też po polsku, ja wtedy przetłumaczę tak krótko pytanie na angielski. If anybody has any questions, any comments, please, you're allowed to, of course.
And for either one of us, for Max as well.
Yeah, but especially for Charles. maybe somebody who has been to Istanbul and maybe has some very different perspective, or somebody who hasn't been but wants to go and now is afraid, for example. Which, of course, these questions of being afraid, I think, so you think about your questions. I will just have one more.
Actually, just it reminds me, when I speak to an American audience about my book on Odessa, I always ask the American audience, how many of you have a relative from Odessa? And it's like all the hands go up, especially in New York.
What do you think about the recent changes in Istanbul? Because when I published my book in 2009, was a second edition, and I gave like a special extra on the end, saying that Istanbul already changed because it's such a lively city and such important city that it's just changing all the time, yeah, because of political, geopolitical changes, etc. And I had this impression, and at the beginning, I have to say, I was not so much against the present Turkish government, the AKP party, because I thought that, for example, what is very interesting, because they were generally anti-Kemalists, so that they were like, officially, they were not again moving the capital to Istanbul, but they were like doing everything to show that Istanbul is more important than Ankara. They were doing all these renovations and all the demolitions as well, which of course you can start a huge discussion about urban structures, etc. But still, I had a feeling that Istanbul is like growing again, like rising again, because it became a focus of their new Ottoman, not nostalgia, but like reinventing Ottoman ideas, of course, in the more Islamic way. What do you think about?
Yeah. Well, I mean, when I first started working on this book, you know, Istanbul and Turkey in general were sort of on the rise. I mean, it was becoming a major tourist destination. Turkish Airlines was voted the best airline in Europe. You know, they were on this massive public relations campaign, and the tourist industry was just really taking off. Unfortunately, what has happened is the war in Syria, the refugee crisis, and the increasing authoritarianism of the Turkish government itself that has sort of put a damper on what I think many people who care about Turkey and care about Istanbul had thought was a very hopeful period just a few years ago. But, you know, this is also part of the longer history of this city, is that it does reinvent itself. New people come into it. The next chapter of Istanbul's history is going to be a chapter that is at least partially written by Kurds and Syrians and Iraqis, and that will be something like, you might say, the Russian refugee crisis of the teens and 20s. I mean, we can't quite picture exactly what this city will be with new immigrant groups that come into it. But I think this book has turned out to be oddly more relevant than I had imagined when I first started, because when we think about what President Erdogan wants to create in Turkey, we often oppose him to Kemalism. We said, well, he's the opposite of the Kemalist Atatürk version of Turkey. Look what he's doing with political Islam. Look at the way in which he's creating a more authoritarian state. But of course, in most ways, Erdogan is exactly like Kemal Atatürk. That is, he believes in the idea of a cult of personality. He is most comfortable with a one-party state, which is what Turkey was in the 1920s and 30s for most of that period. He believes that he is going to forcibly change not only Turkish society, but change the way individual Turks behave, much in the way that Mustafa Kemal did. The critical difference is, of course, the role of Islam in public life. But in most political ways, we have a weird version of neo-Kemalism that I think often goes unnoticed by commentators on Turkey.
Yeah, but would you agree that we can say that in a way the Ottoman Empire still exists? I mean that Kemal Mustafa Atatürk, he was like a sultan,
yeah.
And Erdogan is just another sultan.
Well, Atatürk was trying to impose a European model, right? So when he comes to power, when the Turkish Republic is created in 1923, he wants to rebuild Turkey on a European model. And he does, but it's not the European model of human rights, liberal values, and the one that we like to congratulate ourselves is European. He builds it on the basis of a very strong, overbearing state, a single political leader, a single political party. I mean, it is the 1920s and 1930s, after all. Those are the European values of that era. And so it shouldn't be surprising in many ways that the version of Turkish politics that takes root is precisely the version of politics that the Turks themselves see all across Europe in that era. And the difficult truth at the moment is that Erdogan is not that unusual. The AK Party in Turkey is not that unusual on a European scale or perhaps even on a global scale. The Turks are ones, I don't know if they're following a European model or creating a European model, but it is not anti-European to behave in the way that the Turks are behaving now.
Yeah. Czy ktoś z Państwa już się namyślił nad pytaniem? Już przygotował je w głowie? Okay, I think we have... Okay.
Hello, firstly.
Hello.
Thank you for your remarks. And I have a question about the relations between the Israel and the Turkey from your perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Could you say something about it?
Yeah. Well, this is a very important topic, of course. And relations between Turkey and Europe have gone through, or Turkey and Israel have gone through sort of more and less hopeful cycles, I guess, over the last 20 years. If we rewind about 15 years ago, there was a remarkable alliance, is not quite the right word, but rapprochement between Turkey and Israel for a whole variety of complex strategic reasons. That was then because of the support of some members of the Turkish political scene for Hamas and for other movements in the Middle East. They reached this point where that relationship was very, very cold, and in fact, really awful about 6 or 7 years ago. We're now moving into, strangely enough, another kind of rapprochement period that is not as warm as it was 15 years ago, but is better than it was 6 or 7 years ago. I think the relationship between Turkey and Israel is always going to be a product of how Turks and Israelis assess the strategic environment in which they find themselves. I don't think there's a deep love between the governments of the two countries. I don't think it flows from any cultural connections necessarily. I think it really flows from a very hard-nosed assessment of the strategic environment where they find themselves. And as that strategic environment changes, so too does the relationship. But Max, I don't know if you would have a different view.
I'm not a specialist on geopolitics like you. So, but I think that it's. But it's interesting that nobody asks anymore the question about when Turkey will be part of the European Union.
Yeah.
Like 10 years ago, everybody would ask this question now. I think that everybody understands it. We don't have to ask about
it. I mean, can you imagine a few years ago that we would no longer be asking when Turkey is a member of the European Union, and we would be asking whether Britain is going to be a member of the European Union? It's amazing. You know, no one would have predicted that.
Yeah, exactly. But also, I think that again, this. I think that the question about Turkey and Israel is much more important than the question about Turkey and the European Union. Maybe not, because now the European Union, that's amazing, that's a big change, that the European Union is in the hands of Erdogan because of the refugees from Syria. Yeah, I mean, if you open a border, you know, you can forget about the European Union. I mean, and that's why, of course, European Union agree, you know, to his policies. Yeah, I mean, you don't hear, you know, like huge shouts, where is freedom in Turkey, because we just have to deal with him. I mean, we as the Europeans, yeah. But also, I mean, when I was in Istanbul before coup d'etat, like 3 years ago, let's say, it was really amazing, as you said, like the new citizens of the city. I mean, the Syrian refugees everywhere, every corner. And this is really important, because when we say that there is a refugee crisis in Europe, there is a refugee crisis on the streets of Istanbul. And what is again amazing, that you have all these old houses, 19th century amazing houses in Tarlabashi, for example, which are just, because some of them, they started this huge demolition renovation project. So, for example, do you have a facade of the house or just a shell of it, and it's empty inside, but because some of these renovations, they were stopped, so all these houses are full of Syrian families. Yeah. And it's like really amazing. If you go to Tarlabashi, I mean, I think now they even destroyed some more parts of it, and you should go to Tarlabashi, because Adam Mickiewicz Museum is over there, because I have to remind you that our greatest poet, he died in Istanbul. Yeah, so it's very important. So I think that, you know, Turkey, as it was by the end of 19th century, by the beginning of 20, is like one of the most important places for from the European perspective.
And in fact, if we think about the refugee dimension of this, the international community's response to the series of refugee crises from roughly 1915 to 1923 was one of the great heroic moments in international politics. So with Armenians being pushed out, Greeks being pushed out, Assyrian Christians being pushed out of the Ottoman Empire, and then the Russian refugees, the international community created a massive structure for how to deal with this refugee crisis. They created a thing called a Nansen passport, which was a passport that you would give to a stateless person. They created resettlement programs. They created educational programs. They created special universities so that people who were in university in Russia could finish their degrees in Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Paris, London. That experience of the teens and 20s compared to today should make us very ashamed of how the international community has responded to a refugee crisis that is every bit as tragic and massive as the experience of the teens and 20s.
Okay, any more questions? Czy ktoś jeszcze chciałby pytanie? Because if you don't have a question, then I will have just a very last one, yeah? Because we started by talking about Istanbul, and we love Istanbul, and then now we started all this huge geopolitics. Yeah. But I understand that you made a book about Odessa, you made a book about Istanbul, so I understand that you are like in love with these huge cities, which are like somewhere on the coasts, and they are so rich in the history. Yeah, yeah. And
are you going to ask me if I'm going to write a book about Gdansk? Or that's the next question. Yeah. No, I'm not.
But is it like, I mean, can you imagine writing a book about the jungles of Papua New Guinea?
That's
what I mean.
Yeah, I don't have the skills to do that, but I think I've chosen topics that that allow me to deal with big, gigantic themes in a relatively small place. And I think that's what I'm kind of most comfortable writing about. There are some writers, and I really respect them, who are able to fly like the height of an airplane and survey the field like Henry Kissinger, you know, is able to do in the global geopolitics. I've never been able to do that very well. I like a small place where lots of big things happen to people. But that's also kind of my view of what history writing is. I believe that really good history writing ought to help us understand the lives of other people. I call it an exercise in the moral imagination, that if you can somehow get into the lives of and understand the minds of people you can never meet, perhaps it will be easier to understand the lives and thoughts and ambitions and desires of people you can meet, that is, the people who surround us every day. So reading history and writing history, appreciating history, is like going to the gym for your moral conscience. It's like exercising your ability to have empathy with the people who surround us.
I like this metaphor very much. Yeah, it's cool. Okay, I'm sure that a lot of people, they will have like questions they want to ask you, like eye to eye. Okay.
Yes?
How are you doing?
I've got a question. Maybe I will talk it in. Okay. I've got a question, but maybe I will talk it in Polish because it will be easier for me.
As you might know, we have a war, one of longer wars in between Azerbaijan and Armenia. The war about the Karabakh, Mountain Karabakh region. Will Turkey help to solve Armenia the problem? The question is whether Turkey will help one of these countries.
You know, this is actually an interesting interesting dimension of contemporary politics as well as history, because when the Erdogan government first came to power, when he became prime minister roughly 15 years ago, and the AK party came to power, they began a series of reforms in Turkish public life that made it more possible than at any point since 1923 to talk about the Armenian genocide, to research the Armenian genocide, to talk about Kurds and the plight of Kurds. And there was this massive upsurge in historical writing and music. It was really a kind of golden age for work on these subjects. That, despite the fact that Turkey was supporting Azerbaijan in the ongoing conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan. I think what has happened over the last 5 years or so is obviously a closing of the space in Turkey to discuss those questions. You can still discuss Armenian issues. It's harder and harder to discuss Kurdish issues for perhaps obvious reasons. And there's also a growing distance between Turkey and Azerbaijan, as Azerbaijan itself looks much more to Russia for support. The Azerbaijanis have been very disappointed, I think, in the way that the Turks have supported them over the last 10 or 15 years. And so that relationship, in fact, has cooled. But I'm not very optimistic about a solution to the Armenian-Azerbaijan conflict anytime soon.
Okej, w holu można kupić książkę.
You can buy the book in the hall. Istanbul. At midnight in Para Palace. So those of you who don't have the book might buy it now. Thank you very much for your attention.
One more thing. I promised myself I would do this. I wanted to thank Justine Hunia, who is the translator of this book. Translators never get thanked. And so thank you, Justine, wherever you are.
And thanks to Charles King. Big applause to him.
Thanks.
Charles King i Max Cegielski, dziękujemy organizatorom, dziękujemy Państwu.